Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now, Nell Abernethy, who's the Vice President for Policy and Strategy at the Roosevelt Institute, where she focuses on explaining the causes of the high-profit, low-wage economy and promoting structural solutions around antitrust, corporate governance, and tax policy. She's the co-author with Joseph Stiglitz of Rewriting the Rules of the American Economy, An Agenda for Growth and Shared Prosperity. And she has an article at Talking Points Memo, Democrats Must Become the Party of Freedom. Welcome to Background Briefing, Nell Abernethy.
Thank you so much, Ian. Thanks for having me.
Well, thanks for joining us, Nell. And clearly, the Koch brothers and others on the right have been very successful. Grover Norquist comes to mind in demonizing government itself and basically hoisting the canard, particularly at working Americans, to suggest that government is about enslaving you and the free market is about giving you freedom, when in fact, if you look at the growing income inequality, where the three richest families in America, the Kochs, the Mars family, the Candy family, and the Waltons, their income since 1982 has increased by 6,000%, while the household income of Americans has gone down by 3% over the same period. So those are the facts. Those are the results. But the propaganda seems to have had an effect, has it not, in demonizing government and suggesting that freedom equals freedom for the Koch brothers to exploit workers and be unrestrained in terms of pollution and their obligation to pay taxes.
That's absolutely right. And that's exactly the point my colleague Mike Combs and I were trying to make in writing this piece, is we've seen that the right over the last 30 to 40 years really successfully narrow the vision of freedom for most Americans. So that it means this idea of the government just leaving me alone. But we actually have a long history, particularly in progressive movements, of defining freedom much more broadly than just the right to buy whatever you want if you have money, but rather as both having political power and also economic power. And this idea that Franklin Delano Roosevelt said, necessitous men cannot be free men. To truly have the choice of controlling your own life and charting your own destiny, you have to have a certain baseline of material freedom to go along with the political freedom that we strive to expand through the civil rights movement. And one thing that I think really speaks to this is the famous I Have a Dream speech that Martin Luther King gave. We remember that as the March for Freedom, and oftentimes it's remembered as a civil rights march about legal representation and participation, which was essential. But it was a march for freedom and jobs. The jobs piece was as essential to that mission as the political voting rights.
Well, it's extraordinary, though, when you think, you mentioned FDR, of course, one of the people that he was opposed to, who was, you know, avowedly a pro-Nazi and anti-Semitic, was Henry Ford. But Henry Ford, nevertheless, at least understood that you have to pay your workers enough to buy your product. So what happened to American capitalists where they just want everything and don't seem to understand that at the end of the day, somebody has to buy their products, even though, of course, with the increased financialization of the economy, the richest Americans in many cases, like the Koch brothers, is most of their money comes from Wall Street, and the Mercers and others, they don't produce anything except make money out of money.
So you're right that Henry Ford had a model that was good for workers and good for him. I would say that was very much in his self-interest. The rules and the nature of the economy at that point could structure a business so that what was in his self-interest was also in the interest of his workers and the larger community. We live in a very different world today, partly because of globalization and technological change, but also because of the changes in tax policy, in corporate governance and competition policy that have changed the whole incentive structure for CEOs and shareholders. So firms today are really managed with this idea that their number one priority is to provide returns to shareholders. This means, for example, that profits earned, say, from a massive tax break like the one we just saw, are not necessarily and are quite unlikely to go into the kinds of long-term investments in capital and equipment and research and development and worker training that actually do grow the economy and create broad prosperity. They're much more likely to go to shareholders in the form of stock buybacks. And we've seen this. This is exactly what we've seen. This trend didn't start with the tax cuts, but since the tax cuts, we've seen shareholder payouts on steroids. The other thing they do with this money is buy up other companies. They merge or buy up potential competitors. 30, 40 years ago, we had a much more rigorous antitrust policy that prevented a lot of the kinds of mergers that we see today. So all of this means that for a CEO or a corporation, it's perfectly within their rights to operate as essentially a predatory business that's deriving profits from a lot of activities that are not at all productive. And this can be very profitable. It's just not good for the average American. It's often not good for the broader community. And I should say, this is a key point, because we were promised with the kind of economic freedom that you start off saying the Koch brothers promised, that this would also be good for growth, that it would be good for the economy, and that would ultimately benefit everyone. And that's just not what we've seen. It's not only that these kinds of changes are reducing the sense of power that people have over their own lives. It's also quite bad for the economy. We're not seeing the kinds of investments or productivity growth that we might like to see.
And again, I'm speaking with Nell Abernathy, who's the Vice President for Policy and Strategy at the Roosevelt Institute, where she focuses on explaining the causes of the high-profit, low-wage economy and promoting structural solutions around antitrust, corporate governance, and tax policy. She's the co-author with Joseph Stiglitz of Rewriting the Rules of the American Economy, An Agenda for Growth and Shared Prosperity. And she has an article at Talking Points Memo, Democrats Must Become the Party of Freedom. I recently spoke now with Jonathan Tepper, the author of a new book, The Myth of Capitalism, and he basically is emphasizing that the shift to monopolies and oligopolies are enabling price fixing, which has led to companies seeing customers as their enemy as opposed to their competitors as the enemy. Do you agree with that?
I do agree that that's definitely a trend we're seeing and seeing exacerbated. And it's not every business, but we see the top four or five corporations in a given sector are increasingly dominant so that they can pull this off. And it's also important to note that this is terrible for smaller businesses or businesses who are trying to build real wealth, because they are forced to compete with people who are essentially focused on trying to secure an unfair advantage. And again, I think this all speaks to how you started, was we've successfully demonized government as the enemy of freedom, the enemy of free enterprise, when in fact we actually need government and free enterprise to be in balance. That we've been here before. We were here in the Gilded Age, and we saw that smart regulation and public intervention could create the kinds of structures that allowed businesses to thrive. It just prevented that kind of zero-sum gaming that you're talking about.
Right, but the mechanism by which monopolies and oligopolies have formed and created the opposite of a user-friendly form of capitalism. Just nobody likes their cable company, I can assure you.
Yes.
And all of the big businesses, beer, beef, insurance, health insurance, even funeral homes are now essentially being run by oligopolies. So that's the sort of trend, it would seem, that we're up against. And my sense is that the reason this is happening is that these very people, like the Koch brothers, have managed to buy enough politicians, usually Republicans, who can somehow carry their water for them and con these voters into voting for what they usually call freedom. But in fact, it is a form of capitalist enslavement at the behest of the Koch brothers, where we all get downsized. And they, as I mentioned in the beginning, they and the Mars family and the Walton family, their income increases by 6,000% since 1982.
Yeah, well, I think that there's a lot there that I very much agree with. But this trend, particularly around antitrust, precedes the political activism of the Koch brothers. This is part of really an ideology that we now think of as neoliberalism, but emerged from the Chicago School of Law and Economics in the 1970s, and particularly Robert Bork on antitrust was, the famously failed to confirm Supreme Court justice, was a key proponent of this idea that markets regulate themselves. Monopolies are essentially impossible because there will always be a competitor. Any firm that's trying to do something to secure an unfair advantage is being inefficient. And so there will be some more efficient upstart that comes along and outcompetes them for customers or suppliers. So this idea has a long academic lineage. And most of the current regulators and judges ruling on antitrust cases subscribe to this point of view. And I wouldn't say that they're all necessarily being bought off. It's just the ether, the air they breathe, I should say. So what we really need is an ideological shift that looks at some of these old assumptions and how poorly they've played out in reality. We have that data now. One of the things that's interesting in the economics profession is a lot of these assumptions are based on theoretical models, but thanks to computing power, there's been a real empirical revolution where we can actually test these assumptions. Okay, so do monopolies just compete each other away? And the answer is absolutely not. We've seen more consolidation over the last 30 years. We've seen higher markups over profits. That's what you described as sort of the price gouging phenomenon. And there's a pretty open and shut case with the data.
Right. Well, what you just told us, Nell, reminds me of how Alan Greenspan was completely like a deer in the headlights when the 2008 crash happened, simply because he thought this was impossible, that somehow Wall Street would regulate itself. It would have the necessary self-interest not to allow such a thing to happen. But
that's exactly right. I mean, we have to remember this model of how the firm works or how finance works is based on this idea that profit seeking, doing what's in your self-interest, is most of the time productive and welfare enhancing. And there might be some moments of market failure where, you know, it might be in my self-interest to pollute and not in other people's self-interest, but those are the rare examples. And what we've learned, and many economists have been proving, including Joe Stiglitz, have been proving this for a while, but I think we all learned very clearly with the financial crisis, is market failure is much more common than markets working the way we think they do in models. It is often profitable to do things that are not productive.
Well, I don't think that, though, now there is a you can use the notion, for example, physician, heal thyself in terms of medicine. I don't think that applies. I don't think you can get Wall Street to heal itself, and particularly thinking of like Gary Cohn, who was considered one of the few adults in the room in the Trump administration. The last thing he did was push through this disgraceful tax break for the ultra wealthy and for a few corporations, which they packaged and marketed as a middle class tax cut. And now, in these last weeks before the midterm elections, Trump has had to come out with another lie saying that he's actually going to come up with a middle class tax cut, even while the Congress is in recess. He was going to do it before the elections. That is a de facto recognition that we didn't actually get the middle class tax cut. Gary Cohn and his friends got it, but we didn't. So my sense is that the solutions have to be in the political realm. And as somebody that spent time in different countries, and I grew up in Australia, and remember when I took my two-year-old daughter to Australia to visit the family, they all said, well, go down to the post office and sign her up for child endowment. and I never bothered. But had I done that, my daughter would have been paid $200 a month by the government into an account that can only be opened by the mother, not by the father, because he might drink it away at the pub on Friday night. And by the time she was 18, she would have had a college fund. That is just one of many social services that exist in a functioning social democracy. The American people have no concept of what a bad deal they get. The only vestiges of social democracy we have are Social Security and Medicare, which the Republicans are trying to undo. Right next door in Canada, they have social democracy, but somehow we're immune from understanding that the role of government is you pay them your tax money, and they are good stewards of your tax money, and they spend it wisely, and if they don't, then you boot them out. But their job is to serve you, not to serve special interests. So it feels like we've fallen a long way from grace.
We have fallen a long way from grace. My hope, and one of the reasons that we wrote this piece recently about how Democrats should embrace a different notion of freedom, is that the conventional wisdom that has constrained the vision of freedom and the vision of what the public sector can do for you and the government can do for society, that this is a moment of change. And we see amongst Democrats right now a willingness to promote policies that do have a more ambitious vision for what the public sector can do. We've seen, the Senate, which is not a bastion of left-wing social democracy, talking about ideas like a jobs guarantee, a baby bond. Senator Booker just introduced my colleague Sandy Darity and Derek Hamilton's concept of a baby bond, which is very similar to what you described. Every child would have an account that they could draw on for certain things at 18, either for college or for a down payment or for starting a business. And the idea is this truly begins to provide the kind of freedom that we see, you know, upper middle class or rich kids have who can go to college and envision what their future could be, whether they want to be a poet or an engineer or anything that may not necessarily be the thing that's going to allow them to pay off their massive student debt right away, that all Americans could begin to see that kind of dream be a reality.
Well, just in closing, do you think, for example, the millennials, who are the ones that are being indentured with debt before they even get a job, and most economists will tell you that that's insane, that you need the younger generation as consumers, at the very least, to buy refrigerators and cars and houses, and they can't do that. They can't get off ground zero because they're indentured. Do you think there's a political awakening going on there? I mean, I think to some extent Bernie Sanders seemed to basically awaken and certainly galvanize a lot of young voters. Is that going to grow into a movement, do you think, just in closing?
I think it could be. And, you know, we have a student debt crisis. We have a retirement crisis. We have a child care cost crisis. We have a housing affordability crisis. We have a health care crisis. These are all the basic goods you need to have a decent life. And in many other countries, in many other times in our own history, these are the kinds of goods and services that the public sector has helped to provide. And as average people are faced and squeezed between these crises, to be able to finance the basics of a dignified middle-class American life, I think we're going to have to see political change.
Well, Nell Abernethy, I thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you so much, Ian.
And again, I've been speaking with Nell Abernethy, who's the Vice President for Policy and Strategy at the Roosevelt Institute, where she focuses on explaining the causes of the high-profit, low-wage economy and promoting structural solutions around antitrust, corporate governance, and tax policy. She is the co-author with Joseph Stiglitz of Rewriting the Rules of the American Economy, An Agenda for Growth and Shared Prosperity. And she has an article at Talking Points Memo, Democrats Must Become the Party of Freedom. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at backgroundbriefing.org. We can also contact me. And I'll be back again with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.